Okay, there will be more in the morning that we won't be able to cover now, but let's plow through this section here real quickly about what the Bible teaches about care of the poor, especially as it relates to the government. Remember, we've already seen that both the Bible and the founders defined the role of the federal government to not include providing any benevolence to the poor, but When I studied this material, the thing that just astounded me, and you know, we know this, you've heard the phrase, you need to define your terms. When you have a discussion with somebody, even a public debate, but even any discussion, two people will be talking about two different things, using the same word and listening, they're thinking two different thoughts. But what do you mean by poor? What does that mean? Well, first I want to take you through the Bible definition, then I'll take you through the government's definition. Absolutely eye-opening. It was in the 1960s that the so-called War on Poverty was launched. And they assumed a definition that is simply unsustainable. It's not, in fact, what the Bible teaches. But think for just a moment what you know poor to be in history in general. Forget our current culture in the last 50 years. Let me show you some pictures of how the world has understood the concept of poverty. For example, Charles Dickens, you know, where he portrayed in some of his books like, what's his name?
Oliver.
Yeah, Oliver Twist. "Please, sir, I want some more." These kids were poor. And if you were to look around, remember The Prince and the Pauper, Mark Twain? Look at these rags. Question, in this country, in your lifetime, ever seen anybody dressed like that? This, if I remember right, is World War II. Here's the Depression. Allied bombing raid over Europe. Poor mother and her children during the Great Depression, 1936, Elm Grove, Oklahoma. Dorothea Lange went through and took a lot of pictures during this period. Here's a destitute pea picker in California. She was there in Napomo, California in 1936. Migrant cotton field workers in Sweetwater, Oklahoma. Well, they were from there, but this housing is in Casa Grande, Arizona, south of Tucson. Look at the housing that they had. My parents grew up in, they were born in 1921, both of them, one in Oklahoma and one in Missouri. So they were very familiar with these scenes. That's a nice pair of overalls there. Living in tents. These two pictures. See this stove? I showed this up in West Virginia, and he came up to me afterwards and said, "Do you understand that that's a nice cook stove, and this is a cream separator?" That was a sophisticated piece of equipment back at that time. Well, they have a roof over their head. They've got clothing. They've got food on the table. This is outside the United States, where your stove is, you know, kind of a built-in construction that you came up with. That was typical of most of world history. And you know what the big issue in the Depression was? Not lack of money from the government. No work. And people wanted to work. But they couldn't find jobs. It's the exact opposite now. We can't get people to work and everybody's begging for workers. Look at these men all lined up in order to get some coffee and donuts. Notice they're all dressed nice. There's no work. Shanty towns that grew up in some of the urban areas of America. Now, that's pretty much the extent of poverty in the United States. Now, let's go outside the United States. slums built on a swampland in Jakarta, Indonesia. Now that's true poverty. Children in Uganda, East African children. Look at these rags that they wear. This poor fellow, where in countries where there's no special provision made for people that are blind, deaf, deformed. These can be disconcerting images. But I'm telling you, Americans don't experience this. And if there are in some back village up on a mountain in West Virginia or something, no one in this country has to experience this because the resources are available. This is the poverty that has existed throughout history in the world. Let's come back to America. Here's our poverty. Look at these shoes. Look at that sleeping bag. Look at that coat. And of course, the cigarette. Homeless, please help. The children are well groomed, well fed, expensive stroller. Nice, nice backpack. Look at that nice warm coat. Nice pants, camouflage pants. Look at those shoes. Those are better than any shoes I have, by the way. Wearing nice clothes, nice warm bedding, groomed hair, well-fed physiques. Did you see any ribs showing through on anybody? Sitting around collecting handouts. By the way, some of the so-called street people are those who, one of the political parties, that's wrong, we've institutionalized, so they just turn them all loose. And so you've got people with all kinds of mental problems that are out on the street. We are blinded by our own affluence. Did you know the vast majority of the poor of the world have no refrigerator, no television, no stove or oven, no AC, no phone, no washer, and a host of other amenities that we think are necessities? We can't live without them. But you know, our parents, our grandparents and back, they didn't have them. My dad in Missouri had an outhouse, you know, smokehouse, no refrigerator. They kept the cream or the milk from the cow in the little creek nearby to keep it cool enough, or in the well. Made all their own food, butchered their own hogs. Used everything he said but the squeal. Now here's the truth on the matter. You and I live better than the richest people in human history. You think, well, I don't know about that. There have been some rich people. How about Solomon? According to 1 Kings chapter 9, Ecclesiastes acquired silver and gold, special treasures of kings and princes, tons upon tons of gold, great quantities of spices and precious stones, drinking vessels in his palace were gold. You remember this throne? His throne was pure ivory, overlaid with gold, two lions beside each of the armrests, six steps leading up to the throne with 12 lions, one on each side of the six steps. Every 3 years, merchant ships arrived bringing more gold, silver, ivory, exotic animals. The inspired writer says in 1 Kings 10, he surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. But I'm telling you, you are richer than Solomon. Marcius Licinius Crassus, one of the triumvirate with Julius Caesar, they say amassed a fortune between 200 million and 20 billion. The richest man in history that I could find was Mansa Musa, back in the 13th and 14th centuries, Muslim. He once took a pilgrimage to Mecca, the Islamic annual Hajj, It took 60,000 people in addition to 12,000 slaves. Everything that wasn't actually covered in gold was transporting gold. William the Conqueror, who invaded and seized England, became the first Norman king of the British. Reigned more than 20 years, they say his wealth was an equivalent of $229.5 billion. Here was a very, very wealthy Manchu Chinese dynasty king or official. And I just put down a listing of all of the stuff that he possessed. But I'm telling you that most Americans live better than the richest people have lived in human history. Now let me tell you why. Solomon did not have a thermostat in his palace. Remember the description of the palace that we're given of it, how he built it. He couldn't go over to the wall and adjust the temperature in the whole room. He never flew on an airplane. Didn't have a car. He didn't even have a refrigerator to make cold drinks from. You and I are living better than the richest kings of human history, I'm telling you. I don't care if you have a big, huge room that's stacked clear to the ceiling with gold. What good is it if there's nothing for you to buy with it? So why is America, why do we have all of these luxuries and all of these absolutely incredible things that haven't existed for most of human history? There's only one answer to that. God has blessed us with it. We are richer than anybody else throughout human history. Things that you and I enjoy and take for granted? Absolutely astounding. Look at this. Here is it's 10 years old now, but 99.6% of Americans that are considered poor have a refrigerator. Look at the stats as you go down. 97% of television, stove and oven, microwave, air conditioning, at least one VCR. We're still above 50%, which is down here. This article, Americans live in poverty, that supposedly are in poverty. What, not what it used to be. New report, 80.9% considered poverty stricken have cell phones along with their landline phones. 58% have computers. 96 of those in poverty have televisions. 83% have some sort of a DVR. The typical poor household as defined by the government has a car, air conditioning, two color TVs, cable, satellite TV, DVD player, VCR. And if there are children, especially boys, they have a game system such as an Xbox or PlayStation. In the kitchen, they have a refrigerator, oven, stove, microwave. Other household conveniences include a clothes washer, clothes dryer. The richest people in human history had none of these things. The home of the typical poor family in good repair. The home is in good repair, not overcrowded. In fact, the typical average poor American has more living space in his home than the average non-poor European. You've been to Europe, haven't you? Seen how little everything is, how little space there is? Man, we Texans couldn't handle that. We need wide open. Actually, I'm an Arizonan, but moved to Texas, married a Texan, so I got there as quick as I could and got enculturated. By its own report, this is poor people in our country, designated poor, reporting, self-reporting, not hungry, able to obtain medical care when needed. That's been going on all along. And suddenly we need health care for everybody? How do you think people have been cared for? Hospitals have taken them in. Sufficient funds during the past year to meet all essential needs. Look at this. Here's the world statistics. Did you know right now 50% of the world's population makes less than $2.50 a day. And the total number of those that live on less than $2.50, that's 3 billion, nearly half of the population of the planet. Total percentage of people that live on less than $10 a day, now you're up to 80%. And you know how many children die every day due to poverty in the world, not the U.S.? 22,000 every day. America far surpasses all the countries of the world. By the way, in your lifetime, have you ever opened the newspaper and read, or have you ever known anybody personally who died from starvation in the United States of America? Has that ever been reported to any of us? But they're dying every day all over the world. We Americans, no matter how little we have or earn, we really do not know what poverty is. And I'm telling you, I don't care what the government has been incessantly pounding us with, we don't know poverty. And I'm telling you, we don't have it in the United States. I've seen billboards say, oh, we got so many people below the... Now, you've got your skewed definition, but when you look at reality, we don't have poverty in our country. Let me prove that to you biblically. The poorest Americans are rich compared to the rest of the world in the entirety of human history. So let's define our terms. Let's let God define it. God, you tell us. The poor, it's all over the place in the Bible, right? Lots said about the poor. Well, what does God mean by that? Passage after passage after passage defines it. Here's the definition. A poor person, according to God in the Bible, is a person who lacks food, they lack some type of clothing, and some type of shelter. That's it. If you're not in that situation, you're not poor. Look at the passages. If you've got food and clothes, you need to be content. Paul, are you saying we need to be content when we're in poverty? No. He's saying you're not in poverty if you've got food and clothing. What more do you want? Remember, Jesus made that point in Matthew 6. What more do you need? Anything above that is just God giving you stuff, blessing you. But don't say you're poor. Inadequate food and clothing, perhaps some type of shelter, but even that. How many people in human history have lived in caves? They had shelter from the storms of the world. You go up in Alaska and live in an igloo, which you can make. The materials are right there. You can harness the materials and make you a shelter and live just fine. Then you're not poor. Poor is wearing rags, not knowing where your next meal is coming from, and not having a roof over your head. That's the Bible definition. Let me give you passage after passage that proves that we have an incorrect and unbiblical view. Job 22, Eliphaz telling Job, you're wicked. Why? You've taken away the food and clothes from these people. You're mistreating the poor because you've taken away their food and clothes. He doesn't say anything about, you know, you stole their horses, took their livestock, took their automobiles. No. Food and clothes. Job 24, where Job is describing the wicked. Specifically, he says, the poor are those who diligently seek for food, they're without clothing, and they lack shelter. That's it. Job 31, where Job is trying to prove to his friends, I've not been unfaithful to God. I've helped the poor. Oh yeah, what have you done? Well, I've provided food. I've eaten it. I've given it to them. If I saw anybody without clothing, you find me one such person that's not wearing one of my sheepskins. So I've given them food and clothes. I've not mistreated them. Genesis 28. Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way that I'm going and do two things for me so I won't be poor, give me food to eat and clothing to put on, I'll be content. Why? Well, I won't be poor. And by the way, what else do you expect from God? If God's giving you food and he's giving you clothes and he's provided you with a roof over your head, not only do we have no reason to complain, we have no justification to say, well, you know, I'm deprived. That is simply not true. Deuteronomy 10. How do you to treat the needy elements? Food and clothes. Isaiah 32. This is all over the place in the Bible. Keep the hungry satisfied and not thirsty. Isaiah 41. They seek water. See, it has to do with the basic needs to sustain life. Anything above that, you're not poor. Ezekiel 18. Here's the just man. Who's that? Well, he provides bread to the hungry and covers the naked with clothing. Then move to the New Testament. What did Jesus say? You don't even need to worry about this if you're a Christian. Worry about what? Having food and clothes. That's all God promises us. And we're not poor if we're provided those things. Matthew 6:32. All these things God will provide. What things? Well, two-car garage and two-story building, college education, blah, blah, blah. God never promised any of that. He said, if you'll seek first the kingdom, I'll see that you're fed and clothed. And you ought to be content with that. You know all this. Romans 12, which is a quotation of Proverbs chapter 25. If your enemy's hungry, feed him. Thirsty, give him to drink. See this over and over and over. James 2, how do we know you have faith? Well, you take care of the poor. How so? Give them food and clothes. Now, you know, as a Christian, if you want to give more than that to people and help them in other ways, that's fine. But you're not oppressing the poor if you don't. You just need to see that they're fed and clothed. Passage after passage after passage, the Bible defines poor very precisely and very specifically. If we're going to go by the Bible, we need to look at it carefully. Being poor is lacking the three basic necessities for life. Have you met anybody starving in America? Again, if they are, it's because it's through their own fault, because there's all kinds of means by which you could be fed. Even if you just say, man, I'm not going to ever work again. I'm just going to be a bum and freeload, live in a cardboard box in the alley. You can still get up every morning out of that box and go get food. It'll be provided for you at all kinds of different locations, churches and the like, right? So we don't have anybody starving in America unless they just didn't get out of the box and go get it. Same thing with the clothes. We've not seen anybody clothed like the true poor of the world through history. And there are shelters all over the place, including church buildings. So when I boldly said we don't have poverty in America, I know the bulk of American society would scream at me and throw rocks. But this is the Bible's view on the matter. We don't have poverty in this country. And so we're being sold a bill of goods on that matter. Indeed, one of the greatest travesties that the federal government's perpetrated on many citizens is putting into their minds the idea that they're poor. Oh, I'm poor, so people need to help me. See, they've just degraded those people. They've caused those individuals to have a low self view and a lack of the necessary motivation and gumption to be independent and hardworking and self-sufficient, which is what God demands of us. I'll show you that too if we have time. Christians are not to be dependent and have a mindset of dependency. Now, when you get at a certain age, or can you have certain problems where you need help? Absolutely. It's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the rank and file of Americans who are able-bodied. Though in Montgomery, the panhandlers are on almost every street corner. I hand them an envelope. It has a scripture. If a man won't work, neither let him eat. I drive away real quick, you know, before he opens it. And I don't mean to be unkind. I'm hoping to shake some reality into people. They are disgracing and shaming our streets. And so far as I can tell, they're all well-fed and able-bodied. And right across the street at Walmart or whatever, they have big signs up, we need workers. I had one say, well, I don't have an ID card, and you have to have an ID. Go down to the place where you get ID cards and get it. See, that shows you that it's all an excuse. And you know the horror stories of them going around the street, getting in their Mercedes and driving off at the end of the day. Not right. We need to go back to the Bible. Is that all of that? I guess it is. Oh, I know why. Because we're going to do the Q&A, right? 30, or do we need to do a 30-minute one? If we don't, I'll keep going. Okay, that's number four. Number five. Ah, yes, okay. Let's do this real quick. I've given you God's definition of poverty. Now let's give you the U.S. government's definition. It's heartbreaking and astounding. I went to the government websites in order to ascertain their view. When does an American fall below the what they call the poverty line? For example, the U.S. Department of Commerce, I've gone to their website, Department of Health and Human Services, so these sites, you know, they give it out there. They lay it out there. Here's their definition. A state of privation or a lack of the usual or socially acceptable amount of money or material possessions. The most common measure of poverty that they use is called the poverty threshold, which they set. The poverty threshold is a lack of those goods and services commonly taken for granted by members of mainstream society. Notice the subjectivity associated with their definition. Based on total income received, not including non-cash supplements like food stamps and public housing. Here is the 2020 poverty guidelines in the United States. If you are in a family of four and you make less than $26,200, the United States government deems you below the poverty line. You're poor. Even though more than a third of the population lives on less than $2 a day. So a poor person over there is different from a poor person here. Relative poverty views poverty as socially defined and dependent upon social context. This is all from their materials. Relative poverty defined as having significantly less income and wealth than other members of the society. See, this is socialism. You got a ranch out here? And you got 50 goats? Well, I don't. So I'm poor compared to you. And you need to give me half of what you got. There's the mentality. The government's doing everything it can to force it on our society. Well, that's not measuring poverty. That's measuring that socialistic expression that the president used, income inequality. So we need some redistributive justice. Look at this little simple illustration. You make $50,000 per year, I make $20,000. That's a significant difference. The government says, okay, when you look at all the people, that's a lot lower than the standard person, so they're poor. And therefore, there needs to be a redistribution of that money. And since the government is the one that's assigned itself to do this illicitly, they'll take it from you through taxation. So poverty, according to the government's definition, is based upon comparison with other people. That's all. So it constantly changes. You may fall below the poverty line today. Tomorrow you may not be. It doesn't have anything to do, you see, with God's definition. Are you hungry? Do you lack food? Do you lack clothes? And do you lack shelter? This started as early as the 1980s. And yet, those lines of poverty, which you fall below, they consistently exceed those of other wealthy countries in the world, like the European countries. Which means we consider many people in this country to be poor, that if you go to other countries like, you know, Norway or England or whatever, those same people making that same amount of money, they're not considered poor there. Well, which is it? Are they or are they not? The real question is, who does God consider to be poor? And we've already seen what he said. So defining poverty by income does not take into account, notice this. So here's the government. Oh, you make this much, okay, you're poor, we need to redistribute. They don't even look into well, why are you making so little? What are you doing with your money? In fact, we're already giving you $500 a month in food stamps, and we also give you other things. What are you doing with that? Which I should tell you some of the horror stories I've heard what they're doing with it. But the point is, they're not. The government doesn't want to know what decisions you're making about your money. What did your parents tell you when you were younger? If you ran out of money or something, what did they say to you? How many times did they accuse you of making foolish decisions? By the way, when I was the director of a school of preaching, I had a student come in and say, I broke my glasses or lost them. You probably know what I'm talking about. He said, I wanted to, is there any way the school could help me with a new pair of glasses? Well, notice the, manipulation. You know, I got to be able to see the Bible, study. Well, I don't know why, but for some reason I had enough sense, which is not typical, to say, what have you been doing with your money? Have you spent your money on anything recently? He was honest. He said, I just bought a new pair of rollerblades for $90. Kind of hung his head. Well, and brother, the school can't help you. Was that mean? Harsh? Mean-spirited, unloving. He made a foolish decision. And it's not the government's job to bail anybody out for that. People make choices about schooling, about how they spend their money, budgeting, all the things that many of you, it's a way of life. You know you've got to pay your bills, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. So you do it. You're not lazy. You work. Well, these are biblical principles and concepts. The government is exacerbating the situation by enshrining this kind of behavior and forcing the other citizens to subsidize it. Now, that's the facts of the matter, not from my view or your view. This is what the Bible teaches. By defining poor as a certain level of income rather than in terms of ability to care for self, we leave the impression that the amount of possessions and conveniences define poverty rather than food and clothes, which leads then to socialism and thinking that to care for the poor, we need to equalize everybody and hand them the things. This is an unbiblical objective. It violates several Bible principles. We must not define poor as anyone who has less than me. By the way, we American Christians have in many cases ruined some of our mission work locations. We've gone into civilizations like Indian places where people live fine on what we would consider to be a pittance amount of money. We'll pay their local preachers a bunch of money where those preachers live far above the rank and file citizens. They get corrupted then and start going all over the country and raise more money. We at Brown Trail had to deal with one such fellow. He was collecting money right and left. Brown Trail was supposed to be the overseeing congregation. The eldership was to know what he was making, and they had a listing. In fact, we were sending him $1,500 a month, which in India is about 5 years' annual income. Our elders didn't look into that. Elders going to give an account for how they use the Lord's money. And he insisted on coming over here to raise a bunch more, and he ended up engaging in some illicit sexual behavior with another man's wife. It was unwanted. It was, you know, his approaches and so forth. And finally, our elder sent him packing. We found out that he was collecting money from several other churches that he wasn't reporting to anybody. He was making bunches of money. So our elders cut him off. That's the most we could do, and sent him home. Listen to this. Many, many years later, my daughter went to Freed Hardeman University. And she said, hey, there's a kid here from India, and he's taking all of us out to eat Indian food. We love Indian food. And I said, really, what's his name? And she gave me the name, and it was the son or nephew of this man that we'd been supporting. And I said, well, how can he afford to do that? He said, oh, he's got lots of money. He's been spreading it all over the place. And I've seen that young man over here in the United States, right here in Texas, going from church to church collecting more. Puts up the slides. Look at the work we're doing in India. Our brethren are so generous, so benevolent, so missionary-minded, but naive. This has happened all over the Brotherhood, and we are so generous as Americans and so filthy rich that we want to help people that have less. Maybe we feel a little bit guilty that they have much less, and I understand that. I really do. But we're not helping them to do that. We're corrupting their opportunity to truly face Christianity head on like they should. So that's something for us to think about. We think, well, I've got more than him, so I ought to share. Well, the Bible teaches that you're to share, but you need to be careful how you distribute the Lord's funds. They're really his. Why do some people lack the sufficient means to function comfortably, and so they have to run to the government or to churches, go from church to church collecting money? Why? What's going on? Well, here's some reasons. Mismanagement of money resources, what you buy, how much you buy, whether you save the money like you should. Your choice of education. Well, I'm going to be in a rock band. Okay, fine. You're not going to get a doctor's salary, and don't expect it. I take it back. Nowadays, with our culture upside down, you probably will make a lot of money doing all that frivolous stuff. If you want to make a lot of money, don't become a preacher. You telling the students that, Tommy, I guess? Loss of job can cause people through layoffs and stuff to get into a financial bind. There's legitimate situations. But the person who drops out of high school and then complains that he's poor and is refusing to face the consequences of his own actions. So much of the negative things that happen in human civilization are self-inflicted. Now, that's the facts of the matter. Much of the misery you and I may have had experienced at different times, we probably caused it. And then complain to who? God and everybody around us. Shame, shame. Certainly the government ought not to interfere. I went to the book of Proverbs, 31 chapters, went through it with a fine-tooth comb. What does God say is the reason for poverty? You'd be welcome to have this sheet. Number one, I've tried to group some of them together. Lazy, slothful, inactive, not working, idle, a lot of sleep, indolent. I put all those in one category. That's mentioned over and over in Proverbs. There's a lot of lazy people in the world. And the government's going to prop them up? That's not good for them. Slackness, not being diligent, being inattentive to what needs to be done. Well, paint that door tomorrow. I'll fix that window tomorrow. And of course the rainstorm comes and water comes in, damages more. Well, you're not getting up and doing the things that need to be done. A lack of wisdom, a failure to be frugal, foolish use of resources. That's constant, isn't it? It's standard. Frivolity, love of pleasure, and therefore, you know, I like to drink, I like to take drugs, overeat. We had a member that lived his life drinking, smoking, drugging, doing all kinds of things. And he therefore had a lot of medical bills. Thinking of another young man who just drank and drank and drank as a teenager on into his 20s. Finally, the doctor told him, your liver is in a state of cirrhosis and you're going to die if you don't stop this now. So he did. He pulled out of it. He stopped. But I'm telling you, he's got so many medical bills, and guess who's paying for them? American citizens who have given money to the government by working themselves. So we're literally paying for a lot of people in this country who made decisions that have now caused them to be in a situation. Am I telling you, well, for that reason, we ought not to? I'm not saying it. I'm just telling you that's what's happened. And Proverbs says there are people that get in a predicament, they dissipate their body, they get in a financial mess, and it's because of what they've done with their time and money and effort. That's God's thinking on the matter. I would think the sensible scriptural thing to do would try to help such people, but at the same time not just let the government indiscriminately pour money into their lives. They don't have enough sense to know how to use it. And try to teach them the gospel and get them out of this kind of thinking. Number five, dishonesty and theft. You know how much thievery is going on in America? You know what the Bible says? See, they're probably thinking, man, I'm going to get ahead. I'm getting free stuff by stealing it. Not according to the Bible. One of the causes of poverty is dishonesty and theft. I saw a fellow bring back a one of those huge screens, TV screens, right after the Super Bowl. He went and got it at Walmart with the deliberate intention of watching the Super Bowl and then bringing it back, getting his money back. See, that kind of moral corruption in our civilization has gone to seed. Not treating people the way you want to be treated. Covetousness, desire for someone else to supply our needs. Number seven, fear. And I don't think I can do this. I'm not going to go out there and try. I might fail. It's just an overall fear. And so it cripples a person and they don't do anything. Number eight, being stingy or non-generous. Number nine, a refusal to be corrected. These are explanations given by God Himself as to why poverty occurs in society. And notice, every single one of them has to do with your own personal choices. Does the government take any of this into account? They not only do not, they would not, because that comes out of the Bible. That's a fairy tale book. That doesn't have anything to do with anything. And you're just a racist and mean and stingy. Anyone in this country can get ahead if they're willing to work. Now, that's a fact. That's a fact. And we've seen a lot of people, and it doesn't matter what color you are, doesn't matter what country you're from. We've had foreigners come in, had next to nothing, and rise to great position. You know, here in Texas? What, his parents came from Cuba or something? In fact, they fled Fidel Castro, didn't they? Ted Cruz. There's all kinds of people that have come out of situations where if they wanted to use the excuse, they could say, well, I can't get ahead and I need the government to give me money. But they didn't. Okay, so if not resting on your nationality or your skin color or whatever, then what's the problem? It's self-inflicted. Part of teaching the gospel, you know, that's a broader term in Scripture than we may realize, includes teaching them Christian morality and how to live your life. How was the vulnerable in society under the law of Moses treated? Lend money to the poor without charging interest. That's interesting to me. Don't just give them money. Lend it to them. Don't charge them any interest, but put them under obligation to pay it back. This is God's mind now. Neither favor nor disfavor the poor in disputes. Don't make a profit on food sold to the poor. I've pulled these out of the law of Moses to try to get everything God says to us about this. Don't make a profit on food. So should be few and no poor in the land blessed by God. Think about that. If this land is pursuing God, you're not going to have many poor people. Lend money to the poor even if the year of release is near. Don't keep a poor man's collateral overnight. Pay his wages daily. Every seventh year, the poor are allowed to gather what grew naturally from a fallow field. Landowners were to leave the corners of the fields and the leftovers, so you can run your combine out there, but don't go back through it a second time and leave the corners for the poor to come. And by the way, they have to work to retrieve it. Remember when the manna was given by God? They had to go collect it, as far as like a day's journey away. See, we see God's mind operating through all of this stuff if we'll pour over it. The poor and rich alike were to give the same amount of atonement money. The poor must pay vows, though reduced to what he could afford. The poor may sell themselves into debt, or they can sell themselves into slavery, but they are to be treated as a hired worker. See, the Bible endorses slavery. The Bible doesn't condemn slavery. Not as people are trying to define it. We need to study that, look at it, and see. God's right on all this. Every third year, in addition to the Levites, foreigners, and orphans and widows, they would receive benefits from the tithes. Summary, God's law under Moses required the poor to take far more responsibility for their circumstances than our government in America expects the poor to take. Many Americans desperately need a reality check. No one owes any of us a living. We need to be preaching this from our pulpits. Get it instilled in the next generation. The benefit of living in a free country is we have the freedom to provide for ourselves without interference. God expects us to take responsibility for ourselves. All right, we'll close with this and then have our Q&A. 1961, January 20. Remember the statement that John Kennedy made? 2 years out, 2.5 years out from assassination. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for you. Has any politician said that since? Absolutely not. And then look at this statement that he made to the world. Y'all quit mooching off of us. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do to promote freedom so that every country can get ahead like America has done. It's not up to America to feed the world and fix the world. You all can do that yourselves if you do what we did. Get Christianity in the hearts of your people. That's what our politicians, all of them, ought to be standing up and saying. All of them. Most of our politicians don't believe it. Sad, sad. Look at these solutions from the Bible. Restore the family as God intended. That means one man, one woman, married to each other for life. No shacking up, no illegitimate children. Husband take responsibility for providing for his family. End unscriptural divorce. Discipline your children. So restore the family. Number two, stop the immorality. Stealing, lying, fornicating, begging, idleness. I happen to believe the Bible teaches it's sinful for a person to stand on the corner and beg. Go look at every case of begging in the Bible and see if it's approved by God. Number three, reinstate the work ethic. Bottom line, get married before having children, finish your education, get a job. All the people you know that seem to be needy all the time, always needing help, tell them that. You can get ahead like me. You can have all the stuff I have. Don't think you're dumber or not as smart or whatever. You've got to make the right choices. And they're not hard choices, other than you may not want to do it. But it can be done. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in His way. When you eat the labor of your hands, notice that. The labor of your hands, not somebody else's. You'll be happy, and it'll be well with you. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine in the very heart of your house. Your children like olive plants all around your table. Thus shall the man blessed who fears the Lord. So it's not the role of the federal government. And even on the state, local level, it needs to be carefully dealt with. Well, yeah, let me show you this. Benjamin Franklin, writing concerning England. This is back in 1766. Look at this. I'm for doing good to the poor, but I differ in opinion of the means. I think the best way of doing good to the poor is not making them easy in poverty. Leading or driving them out of it. In my youth, I traveled much. I observed in different countries that the more public provisions were made for the poor, the less they provided for themselves. And of course became poorer. And on the contrary, the less that was done for them, the more they did for themselves and became richer. There's no country in the world where so many provisions are established for them. This was in England. So many hospitals to receive them when they're sick or lame, founded and maintained by voluntary charities, by the way, not the government. So many almshouses for the aged of both sexes, together with solemn general law made by the rich to subject their estates to a heavy tax for the support of the poor. Under all these obligations, are our poor modest, humble, and thankful? Do they use their best endeavors to maintain themselves and lighten our shoulders of this burthen, this burden? On the contrary, I affirm there's no country in the world in which the poor are more idle, dissolute, drunken, and insolent. The day you passed that act, he's talking to Congress or to Parliament, you took away from before their eyes the greatest of all inducements to industry, frugality, and sobriety by giving them a dependence on somewhat else than a careful accumulation during youth and health for support in age or sickness. In short, you offered a premium for the encouragement of idleness. And you should not now wonder that it has had its effect in the increase of poverty. Repeal that law, and you'll soon see a change in their manners. Saint Monday and Saint Tuesday will cease to be holidays. 6 days thou shalt labor, though one of the old commandments long treated as out of date, will again be looked upon as a respectable precept. Industry will increase, and with it plenty among the lower people. Their circumstances will mend, and more will be done for their happiness by inuring them to provide for themselves than could be done by dividing all your estates among them. Right now, if all Americans just took half or more of their money and gave it all to the poor, it wouldn't be very long. We'd be back in the exact same situation. This is a failure to understand human nature and God's principles on the matter. Well, this is such great stuff, but I'm going to hurry on because industry and constant employment are great preservatives of the moral. By the way, is our morals and virtues going down in our country? Is that unrelated to the idleness and indolence and the laziness? They're connected. Instead, serious religion, he says, under its various denominations. He's talking about the Christian religion. John Witherspoon was a founding father, happened to be a Presbyterian minister. But once again, same principles. I thought we were about through with this. So get all citizens working according to these men will reduce crime. It's a moral duty. It's necessary to national prosperity. And it's the only way God will bless us. Unbelievable. Jefferson talks about, this is all I think in the book, Jefferson talks about how they handled the poor. And he says what we did was, in each of the parishes, there was a group of local men, you know, farmers and prominent men in the community, and they're close enough to the situation where they can see who this person is that's wanting help. And if he's lazy and a bum, then we put him in the workhouse and make him work and try to shame him, especially when he's got a wife and children that he's not taken care of. It's all great, sensible stuff that can be handled on the local level. Government doesn't need to be piping money in here to banks to pay anybody. If you've got people that are indigent and poor, they need to come to the church or come to the local government. They need to look into their circumstances and see what their situation is and help them get out of it. You willing to come and work? We'll get you a job. If he says, no, I'm going to Brownwood. Bye-bye. It's up to the Brownwood people to do the same thing. If everybody get their thinking straight about all this, you could end this overnight. All right. Federal government not involved. Welfare confined to local communities. Friendship and neighborliness animated the relationship between those who gave and those who needed. Careful distinction between the deserving and the undeserving poor. Able-bodied vagabonds helped, but they had to work. Where, by the way, they were disciplined. Even spanked, so to speak. Whipped, if they needed to be disciplined. Are there a lot of people in our country that need to be whipped and spanked and disciplined that didn't get it as children? And they're rampant in their crime activity? I'm telling you, they need to be taken out with a bullwhip and the skin stripped off their back. There's probably not anything else. If you can reclaim their spirit, there's probably not anything else that will do it. Putting them in a cell for 50 years won't do it. They need to be treated in such a way that they're disciplined in such a manner that they will. You know, I remember one time when my dad took off his belt. And it wasn't too long, honestly. I thought I was going to die. I remember that vividly. I thought, I'm going to die. Do you know what that did in sobering up my spirit and making me realize that life is fragile and you had better drop all the pretense and all this stuff and get your thinking straight? There needs to be more psychology books written about that. Because kids, citizens aren't getting it. Do you remember Solomon said? Listen to this. This is wiser than all the adolescent psychology you can get anywhere in our country, in any university. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. That takes a lot of exploration to think about that. But the rod of correction will drive it far from him. Now there's God's wisdom that's so deep that you need to dig into it and go deeper and deeper and deeper. And our society's dismissed. That's barbaric. That's child abuse. We'll put you in jail for that. We're upside down. All right. I'm sorry. Gone a little bit too long. We shouldn't be fighting poverty. We need to be promoting economic self-sufficiency and encourage people to practice Christian principles in life. Oh, I wanted to show you one other thing here. Ola Abraham Lincoln, in his Lincoln-Douglas debate, the seventh one up in Illinois, he said, he's talking about slavery. You work and toil and earn bread and I'll eat it. Well, that's very typical to what's going on here right now in our country. But see, the slavery's not what you think. Look here. Slavery in our country was, we own your living quarters, we'll give you food, we provide your health care, you got to obey, you're dependent on the master, you work for the master, and there was a dehumanizing, wasn't there? fornication to create more slaves. Well, what's the federal government doing? Well, we'll provide you with government housing. We'll give you food stamps. We'll give you medical care. Now, you're expected to vote for us, and you'll be dependent on the government. You won't have to work, and we will encourage immorality because we will pay you for every child you have out of wedlock. Will you please tell me what the difference is? And who is it that's accused of being racist and just like the slavers in back in the 1800s? But who is actually right in mind step with the slavery that occurred in the 1800s? See, usually error parades itself as truth. And God's going to hold all of us responsible for sifting through it. If people don't care to study, then they will be lost. You know, you think God's going to say, well, you didn't take the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. I'm sure he will. But I feel like he's going to say, you didn't care to study my Bible and see that you're supposed to be taking the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. So the prior sin of not obeying God on that is you didn't look into it and show yourself approved and come to an understanding of the truth. You didn't care to. That in and of itself will condemn you to an eternity of hell. Serious, serious business. America was built on the work ethic, and that came right from the Bible. I remember now where we're going with this. Passage after passage after passage that says God wants us to work. It is an absolute indispensable thing. If you are physically able to do it, God demands that you do it. That's just not emphasized in our culture. But we're going to have to stop here. I may pick up here tomorrow for those of you who will be here. All right, I'm sorry. If you want to do some Q&A real quick.
It'll be so. That's good stuff.
If you have any other questions and want to write them and give them to him real quick, that's fine with me.
You know, I think what you're seeing on some of this is it's like an onion. This stuff is layer upon layer upon layer. And when you leave God, the way of the transgressor is hard. And it's infectious. Evil men shall wax worse and worse. And this stuff runs, these roots run down into many different areas of our lives. And you're seeing this idea of poverty, this is a big one. And most of y'all know that we're in the insurance business and your rates have been going nuts and going crazy. There's a term out there that's floating around as to why these things are going up. One of them is called social inflation, which is this mindset of when we have a lawsuit, you punish the big bag rich company and you give these massive, what they call these nuclear cases, these nuclear penalties or payments, judgments. And some of them over $1 billion. Who pays for that? Every individual policyholder. Just like the taxes, the same thing. This stuff is infectious. The minds of people, they're covetous, they're angry, they're bitter. The way the transgressor is hard. When you leave God's principles on any area, it just saturates every area of our existence. So you see it in the home. You see it in the definition of poverty. I don't know if you listen to him talk, you think, man, that sounds pretty harsh. It's not harsh at all. Food and clothing. And from a macro position, what else do you need? We're going to heaven, aren't we? This life is temporary. You live one day at a time. Food, clothes, next day, next day, next day, next day, eternity. That's all you need, right? Ultimately, the cars, the stuff, it's about thinking correctly. Great, great stuff. I found that to be, that's my favorite session. That was pretty interesting, especially that first section about what real poverty is. And then we had the gall to complain. I don't know. It made me feel kind of embarrassed to even think about complaining. Quick question. You emphasized this two or three times in the prior session, a few of them, about the war question. And you talked about defensive war. Have you ever had anybody come back and say something like, well, that means we can't preemptively strike someone. Like say, you know, we can only like defend the castle. You can't ever invade the enemy. And of course, go to World War II. Most of war we took to the opposite. So could you clarify what you mean by defensive war so far as the actual tactics of the carrying out of the battle and combat?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what scenario would be preemptive, but I would assume that too is anticipating what is coming down the pike. So if we have enemies, you know, for example, don't our security forces are not undercover, you know, yeah, the ones that can, that know what's going on, they're monitoring communication and so forth. So if we find out, hey, there's some terrorists, you know, in Iran, and they are planning this, and they're going to come and detonate nuclear devices in New York or whatever, well, there's your offense. So, yeah, I would think that biblically you have a right to respond to that and try in hopes of stopping it before they actually do it. I don't think God's saying, well, no, you got to wait until he comes and starts, you know, doing this or that to you. No, this is you're not the aggressor, right? After 9-1-1, I mean, they were the aggressor. But then did we not take, you know, the steps in order to go after every one of those? They tried to track them all down. And that wasn't aggressive in the sense of we're trying to initiate oppression against anybody. We were simply responding to what they had done. I believe the Bible would affirm that.
When Israel went into the promised land, that was an aggression to destroy them so they wouldn't be infiltrated by the evil. That's an example of that.
That's true. Very much so. Now notice that we would need God to inform us on something like... if God wanted us to go attack, you know, Russia. Well, we can't do that. The reason why the Israelites could do what they did was God knew the whole picture and knew what was... Remember, yes, he was giving them land, but it's clear to me that's not the main reason why God had them do that. He says over and over, it's because of the wickedness of these people. Remember back in Abraham's day, he said, well, their iniquity's not quite full. Well, by then it was. And God's overarching providence and time frame, he knows all of this. And so the time came, so he simply made their destruction coincident with giving the land to them so that then the redemptive plan could be carried on out. So that's how I think I would understand that.
That's kind of how you presented it. It was kind of like a difference in what Rome did in just kind of conquering the world. Their idea was, even as they initiated the war, was since their rights were being taken, they were defending themselves in that sense, even though there's some give and takes as far as combat.
Can anybody think of any time in American history where we have been the aggressors? Because the liberal element says, oh, yeah, all over the place.
Civil war.
What?
Our own civil war.
That's true. That's true.
But
America has never been an aggressor nation. The rest of the world has. They're constantly trying to conquer others and take this and take that. We've not been interested in that. And we were accused of that. Where was it? And we were trying to get out of there as quick as we could and get our people out of there. They said, no, you're an occupation army. You're trying to take over our country. That's a bunch of bunk. We were not. We've never had any designs as a country to try to take others and conquer them. But that's been the condition of all of the conquering nations throughout world history. That ought to tell you something right there about America.
Any other questions? Brother Dave, yes, sir.
I was going to make a comment on that. I do see another perspective, though, you know, because we're the only nation that has like hundreds of bases all over the world, you know. And so whilst I hear what you're saying about people saying we're aggressive and whatnot, there's some merit to that because no other nation has that.
Right, but...
we go in there and if you look at our industrial military complex now and how things have been prepared now, you know, there's some merit to that idea.
See, I don't think there is. You understand what he's talking about? He's saying we have bases all over the world. See, you need to go look at your history. Most of those developed after World War II. It was a realization by the NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that we have got to prepare and anticipate for Nazi-like figures, Hitler. And so we formed an organization of nations, Union, what's it called?
UN.
Yeah, UN has come out of that too. But the idea was, let us situate ourselves where we can anticipate this and be able to respond to it if they are an aggressor. We're not trying to conquer anybody when we do that. And all of these countries have willingly given us that land to use. And by the way, who pays for all of these efforts to keep other countries safe? Who's paying for the Ukraine war now? You know, you and I have no reason to do that other than what could come out of it with us with regard to Russia. That makes it defensive. We're simply trying to anticipate I think our people love the Ukrainians and want to help them, but it's not our job to go all over the world and save everybody from everything that happens. So generally, our State Department and back the World War II generation in particular, they understood that we have got to anticipate some of these aggressor nations and go ahead and get ready to cope with them in as most effective manner as possible. That means getting permission from various countries to let us establish bases in order to be prepared to deal with them so that, notice this, so that the war never comes to our shores again like it did in Hawaii. When 3,000 of our boys and girls were killed.
It's a deterrent by having them there as well. So you actually stops war by having the presence there to begin with.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Ma'am.
So I wonder if you address the subject of immigration as we see it now as Christians.
Is that on tomorrow's stuff, the immigration material, or not?
Yes, I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
The immigration material will be on tomorrow. But that's what we're looking forward to, too, is kind of a Christian response to that such thing.
There is a big section in that God of Government book. If you all are interested in that, I would go look at it because... I don't think we've made this book a free PDF yet. We eventually will on our site, but I went into a lot of that to see what is God's view of the foreigner. You know, there were foreigners that were allowed to come into to Israel. So what about that? You know, should we just ban all immigrants, or is it appropriate for us to allow some in? And obviously there is. God allowed them into Israel. But man, he had some very rigid qualifications and circumstances under which immigrants were allowed to come in. Illegal immigrants, I could not find any reference anywhere in the Old Testament to illegal, just that word stranger in the King James. But you piece together what the Bible says about it, God wants people to be law-abiding. So let's say you decide, well, you know, I want to move to Germany, so I'm just going to go over there and sneak in there and start living there. I believe God would count that as sin.
So would they.
So if somebody illegally enters our country, that's wrong. By any standard you want to give, that's wrong. They don't have a right to do that. We have laws that govern how you can come into our country in a legal fashion. So when any of our people, you know, and I've seen, you know, Catholic bishops and all kinds of people weigh in on this and say, oh, you know, we're being unchristian if we don't. I think the Pope did. We're being unchristian if we don't just let people storm our borders. You won't find any defense of that from the Bible. So that's just your own little cockeyed view. God doesn't support that.
It goes back to those unalienable rights to a degree. Hmm. The concept of autonomy is what's being attacked. The idea of a nation's right to exist, one, you know, language, culture, borders, just like you as a person, the ownership of property, it's all tied together the same.
Yes,
the forces that oppose the one oppose the other. Because, again, it's individual autonomy, your body, your mind, your what you say. And when it comes to religion, how you worship, all that's what's under attack.
Because he was talking about aggression and being, we should not be aggressive. But to me, it seems like we're just sitting back. Should we become aggressive? I mean, that's why I'm asking. You just almost feel helpless in it.
But by aggressor nation, I meant we're not out going after countries and attacking and trying to take over their land. Should we be aggressive in defending ourselves and preparing to defend ourselves? Absolutely. You know, all of the founders said that. Who was it said, walk softly and carry a big stick? Teddy Roosevelt. You know, that's around 1900. But going back to the founding era, they said the same thing, that you have to prepare yourself. Washington had some great quotes on that where he thought through it and said, you know, we're not out to hurt anybody or anything, but we'd better be prepared to discourage people from hurting us. And the only way to do that is to be strong militarily where they'll think twice because they know that we are well capable of taking them out. Right on down to the World War II generation, that was the standard American policy. So why would our politicians try to alter that now and deplete the military? I'm telling you, it's because they hate America. They want America to go down. They would love to see a complete one of our presidents said that. When I get finished, you will see a complete transfer. What was the words he used?
Transformative.
Transform America. Well, look back now. Come on, we're not this dumb. He did exactly what he said he was going to do. He's moved us further down the road to socialism and Marxism than any previous president. And we're not finished yet. There's still lots of people that are more vocal now. They're coming right out with it. Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do. They hate America.
That poster about that same timeline, picture of John Wayne, it said, America, greatest country in the world. Beside that picture of President Obama, come help me change it. You know, so let's change it. And that's what they've been doing. So it's not a political matter as much as a moral matter as far as the doctrines. Anything else? Again, thank you. I know it's been a long day in some way. It's been a good day. And we're very thankful for those of y'all who've come from other congregations. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. And if you're available tomorrow, come back. 9:45 tomorrow morning's Bible class. Regular times here for our membership. 10:45 for worship. We'll have another lunch. And then we'll have 2 o'clock session tomorrow afternoon. And that will be our final service tomorrow.